I'm an American sitting in Russia, and my guest today, believe it or not, is an American engineer with a Russian name. And I think he even spent part of his life living on a boat. And this video, he's going to tell us who he is. He's going to give us his opinion of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And if you are one of these people that already knows all of this information, we're going to try and take it a little bit deeper. Welcome to Expat American. I am the Expat American with perhaps an ex-expat Russian. Find out what's going on in the world right now. All righty, sir. So to start off, I'd like to ask my guests very simply, who are you?
My name is Dmitry Orlov. I was born in Leningrad. My parents took me to the States when I was 12. I finished all of my education in the United States, had a career or several careers in the States, and then about a decade ago, my wife, my son, and I moved back to Russia. Before that, we spent about another decade living on a boat, a sailboat, sailing around the eastern seaboard of the United States. So it was a gradual transition of leaving the United States. First, it was just something on the horizon, and then it was something on the other side of the world. So we took it one step at a time, and it worked out rather well. Now we're living in Russia. Happy to be here. It's a great place.
Fascinating. I've met a lot of people that have spent their life in both countries since I started doing this. What is it about you that you think has put you into the spotlight? What is unique about you, would you say?
Well, a little over a decade ago, I wrote an article just on the spur of the moment. It was something that I was thinking about. I had a technical job. I was taking care of internet security for companies like Federal Express at the time, basically managing rooms full of servers for them. And I wrote an article called Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century because I realized that the United States was moving in the same direction that the Soviet Union was before it collapsed. So, thinking through the entire process, I found out that the United States is much worse prepared for collapse than the Soviet Union was. The Soviet Union was inadvertently prepared to survive collapse and rebound, whereas that is not the case for the United States at all. And so I decided to, as a public service, to warn people as to what I think is coming. And of course, everybody laughed at it and invited me to various conferences where I gave keynote addresses where everybody laughed. I was a dinner speaker because it was so entertaining to hear that a Russian talk about America collapsing like the Soviet Union. That was just like ridiculous but funny. And eventually they stopped inviting me because people stopped laughing and started crying.
Wow, that is amazing. So you're like a real life Dinner for Schmucks person, like that movie. Very,
Yes.
very, very
Yeah.
interesting. Wow. Okay. So, I mean, your words carry weight because you were born in Russia, raised in America, became, a solid adult, and then chose to move back to Russia, of your own free will. You had either place you could live in. So most people are probably thinking at this point, this guy thinks Russia's the better place to be. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Basically, in the United States, we were living on a really elderly yacht that I spent a lot of time maintaining. Didn't really have the resources to send our kid to a reasonable private school, although even the private schools in the US are kind of garbage at this point, I think. And really didn't have the ability to be middle class, whereas we moved back to Russia and we have an apartment in this historical center of St. Petersburg, which is beautiful. We have a house in the country. Our kid goes to a neighborhood school, which is excellent. Has all of the opportunities that he can avail himself of, depending on how smart he is and how hard he works, because it's pretty much a meritocracy in Russia, unlike the United States. And so it's a much better life. It's just a much better life. And on top of that, I happen to be Russian. You know, that's my superpower, my survival trick for moving back to Russia. See, if you're already Russian, then you already know the language, you already know the culture, you're not really distinguishable from the general population, and you just meld in, which is what I did. Nobody at, you know, I'm going to tomorrow, I'm going to the parents' meeting at my kid's school. I bet that nobody at that meeting will even have the remotest idea that I might be an American. That's just like, you know, an unreasonable thing for anybody to think. So, you know, I think I had a much easier time than your American expats such as yourself would have moving to Russia. There's just no culture shock, nothing.
Well, I at least have a Russian wife, but yeah, I can only imagine what it's like for some people where the husband and wife, neither one are Russian, they move here with their children. How is it for your child? Because your child was born in America, correct?
Yes, but he lived on a boat, first of all, with us. He spent all the summers in Russia with his grandmother, and my wife flew back every summer. So he was a Russian kid. He spoke some English, but it wasn't interesting for him. He had this idea in his head that English is for stupid people who don't know Russian.
Right.
You know, that was his childish take on the whole thing.
Right.
And now he studies English at school.
Well, I mean, it's a big deal, you know, if we think deeply about it, you know, choosing to move to a different country to raise your children, you know, it's not just a decision for yourself. You know, you're a person is changing, you know, generations of their family line to be, as far as how they're going to be, how they're going to be raised, what they're going to experience. You know, I mean, my family line left Russia in 1898, you know, and that was a big deal when they decided to move. You know, they had an effect on a couple of generations, and now I'm having an effect on my future generations or descendants, and you will as well. So you wrote the book about stages of collapse.
I wrote a book called The Five Stages of Collapse. And before that, I wrote a book, which is probably the best that I ever managed to put out, called Reinventing Collapse, which was a direct comparison, category by category, of what the Soviet collapse looked like and what the American collapse will look like or looks like now. Those books are still in print. People are still reading them. They haven't aged a bit. And what's more, taking into account what's been unfolding in the United States, it turns out that I was right on the money the entire time. So as a predictor, it seems that, you know, I inadvertently or was by sheer luck, you know, ended up as one of the better predictors of what's happening.
So I assume that you looked at different countries through history and you were able to categorize their collapse and then lay that onto what may happen to the US, to Russia, et cetera. And does each country have just one type of collapse, or it could have multiple of these collapses?
Well, what I did was I categorized collapse into stages so that I could talk about each one separately. So I separated it into financial collapse, commercial collapse, political collapse, social collapse, and cultural collapse, so that I could talk about each one. And I specifically, because you write about what you know firsthand, not what you dig out from libraries. That's generally, you know, if you want to be a popular author, that's the way to go. If you want to be an academic, then you bury yourself in books and are never heard from again. But I basically wrote about what I experienced firsthand, because I was in Russia during the collapse of the Soviet Union. I spent several extended visits here. I had family here, friends, etc. It was quite engrossing and amazing to watch the events unfold. So that's what I wrote about. In terms of what I projected for the United States to happen, well, you know, I lived in the United States in a number of different places and could observe the overall general trends and projected those trends out. And it turned out that was relatively accurate.
How did Russia and Ukraine end up in a military conflict?
Russia intervened in the early months in the spring of 2022 to stop genocide by the Ukrainian Nazis, armed and controlled by NATO and by the United States, against Russian cities and Russian civilians. And Russia was forced to do that to stop that genocide from occurring, which Russia did successfully. And that battle is continuing to this day.
Now, for the cynical people that don't believe what you said, just to break it down further for them, because I believe what I understand as an American coming over here, it's something like the country Ukraine covers a part of the world that has historically been Russian on one side of the river and other countries on the other side of the river. Would that be the way you might describe it to, let's say, a U.S. citizen that doesn't know better?
Well, not really. I mean, first of all, there's no such country as the Ukraine.
Okay.
It ceased to exist when the Soviet Union collapsed, and then it was reconstituted through a piece of paper a friendship and cooperation agreement between the Russian Federation and the regional government in Kiev, what was regional government until then, granting them sovereignty in exchange for political neutrality, nuclear disarmament. A military overthrow of the constitutional government of Ukraine occurred in the spring of 2022, which invalidated everything. It was unconstitutional based on the Ukrainian constitution. It violated the terms of the agreement. And then the new government that the Americans installed in Kiev refused to extend the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only piece of paper that defined the border between Russia and the Ukraine
okay.
as the border of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic was not a country. It was a region of the Soviet Union governed from Moscow.
Okay.
And it included a bunch of territory, Russian territory, settled by Russians, cities built by Russians, including Odessa, including Kharkov, including Donetsk. And those were lumped in by Lenin in order to make this region easier to govern, because the further west you go, the more you have populations that are illiterate and only speak in dialect and are hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So by including these core Russian regions within this Ukrainian, supposedly Ukrainian region, Lenin thought that it would make it easier to govern and easier to develop economically. And maybe he was right, but he created a long-term disaster by so doing.
Okay. And when you mentioned earlier Russian people and Russian cities, you meant in the territory that Ukrainian government would consider Ukrainian, but that are historically Russian places.
Well, they're not just historically Russian, they're just basically Russian. You go there and everybody is Russian, the signs on the storefronts are in Russian. What is Ukrainian, considering that 95% of the population of Ukraine speaks Russian?
Okay.
I mean, before this new nationalist thing occurred, 2014, you really had just a population that spoke in dialect for fun. It was unthinkable that people in Kiev would speak anything other than Russian. I mean, if somebody on the bus in Kiev started speaking in Ukrainian, everybody would laugh. Like, what a strange, folksy character. What are you doing in the city? Go back to the village. That would be the attitude, you see.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think I've heard it said that you know, if Russia has to keep moving, you know, the conflict across the country, they might not want to go past Kiev. So what is the difference between East and West Ukraine?
Up to the Dnieper River, there's no question that it's Russian territory.
Okay.
Beyond the Dnieper River, there's a question as to whether Russia wants that territory at all. maybe it wants the territory. Who knows? It's really up to the people who live there to decide whether they want to be with this rump state called Ukraine, which is defunct, that only survives as long as Western countries throw money at it. Or whether they want to be independent. Most countries, most little regions can't support sovereignty. Sovereignty is expensive. It's a luxury item.
Right.
Or if they want to join Russia. So
right.
They'll have to have referenda, and based on those referenda, they'll decide what they want to do. And that is the only democratic mechanism for determining their future status.
Right. What do the people want? So how are they culturally different then, would you say?
You see, Russia has developed very drastically over the past 20 years or so, maybe 15 years, because there was a period of time when Russia was deteriorating rather than developing. But starting in the year 2000, maybe a little later, and accelerating, Russian society has really transformed itself so that corruption now, it does exist everywhere in the world, but it was dominant in Russia during the 1990s, and it's sort of in the background now. And lots of people go to jail for corruption still, but they go to jail for it. It's prosecuted. Whereas in the Ukraine, corruption is the system. The regime in Kiev is structured around corruption, structured around money laundering. They get weapons from the West and they sell them to Mexican drug cartels. And Mexican drug cartels send over their people for training on how to use those weapons against Americans. So that's just one pattern of corruption. Another is all the money that they get from the EU and formerly from the US gets laundered and given back to the politicians involved as kickbacks, which is why there's an incredible frenzy in the EU, all these people that are used to going to Kiev and collecting suitcases full of cash and dragging it back to the lair. What are they going to do if the conflict ends? So they're doing anything they can, trying to come up with whatever plan they can conceive in order to extend the conflict and continue getting those kickbacks. So it's just a corruption scheme. The whole Kiev regime has become one unified corruption scheme.
So you're saying the main motivating driver is people in charge that are just making money off of this military engagement, off of the deaths of people and families.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Who is pulling the strings on Ukraine? Because I assume you would say it's not just the Ukraine government.
Well, it's the intelligence comes from the U.S. Okay. The command and control comes from the U.S.
Okay.
The weapons come from NATO. The training comes from NATO. Well, draw your own conclusions. Who is in control? It's Washington, D.C. and Langley, Virginia. Those are the two power centers in the Ukraine.
Okay. What about the U.K.? What's their role in this?
The U.K. is very good at being a nuisance at this point, but not really much more than that. I mean, the U.K. has degenerated to the point where they can't even take care of themselves, never mind anywhere else in the world. But they still have, international men of mystery with a license to kill, just sort of running amok and doing whatever damage they can around the world. But it's rather limited at this point, I would say.
Because I've heard the phrase like a U.S. attack dog type of thing. Is it something like that where they're like, could they be characterized as like a vicious pet for the U.S.?
They'd love to be characterized that way. I mean, they don't really want to be like a lab dog, which is what they most likely will end up as or are already. But I really don't think that the Brits really add up to much at this point.
Why doesn't Russia call it a war? Why do they call it a special military operation?
Well, who is that war with? I mean, if you want to have a war, right, you have to have an enemy that you declare war against. Now, is it the Kiev regime? Well, no, because it's not a sovereign regime. It's controlled from across the ocean. So it's basically a proxy conflict, and declaring a war against a proxy is sort of useless because if there's one proxy, there can be another and another, etc. So that seems rather pointless. Is it a war against the United States? Well, no, because that would be a nuclear conflagration. Nobody wants that. It's a regional problem. Is it a war against the Ukrainian people? Well, no, because the Ukrainian people are Russian. They're just Russians who speak with a regional accent. But they're Russian Orthodox religiously. Their culture is basically Russian until there was this effort to come up with some kind of a local anti-Russian thing. They watched Russian television, Russian shows. They moved back and forth. I mean, the level of integration between Russia and the Ukraine is such that if Ukrainians move to Russia, nobody knows that they're Ukrainian. Maybe the first generation, there might be a hint of something, but their children just become Russian instantly.
I mean, this is what I could say as an American, because I'm not from this area originally. It's hard for me to see the difference. And, one of my more popular videos, I went to a Ukrainian restaurant in Moscow, and I was asking, all these questions with the different people there with me and of the restaurant to try and figure out what the difference was. And it was almost like a joke. Like, I couldn't figure out, how does this Ukraine, what makes this Ukrainian as opposed to Russian? So it was very eye-opening for me. For people that are like, let's say, just incensed with this conversation and they're all for Ukraine and they're trying to listen to us and they're getting mad and they're thinking, why doesn't Russia just leave them alone and just stay on their side? All these terrible things are happening. People are being deleted. I assume, like you said, that the idea is if Russia were just to pull back and just, let's say, leave them alone, then this not legitimate mafioso type government is going to go back to doing terrible things to the people of the country.
Well, yes, basically it's a terrorist cult in Kiev, and it thrives on corruption. It is supported by the West, and it has to be dealt with. Russia has no choice but to deal with it. It's sort of like, rats in the rafters or something. You have to get rid of them. Russia does not really have a choice to just sort of let it go. It doesn't have the luxury of that choice. And in terms of who is Ukrainian, who is Russian, well, it's pretty easy. Ukrainians are subservient to Washington, and Russians are not. This is how you draw the line. In
Nice.
terms
I
of
appreciate
anything
that.
else you might say, well, you see, I'm Ukrainian because my father was born in Kiev. I have two grandparents who were born and lived in the Ukraine. My first love was Ukrainian. Lots of my friends throughout my life have been Ukrainian. So I'm about as Ukrainian as you get, except I'm not subservient to Americans. I live in Russia and I do whatever I want.
Is it something like saying I'm from Texas in the United States?
I suppose, yes.
Just like
I'm from
just
Alaska.
a specific territory. What are the best and worst likely conclusions to this conflict, would you say?
I don't think that there are any good conclusions because the damage has already been done. It's absolutely awful. I mean, an entire very large, prosperous, rich, fertile, historically rich and significant region has been utterly devastated.
Because it's
And
approaching 2 million on just the soldier side alone, correct? So it's got to
yes,
be.
if you consider it as an ethnic group, the Ukrainians as an ethnic group, they're done. They will never come back. The young people have left. The birth rate has fallen through the floor. It's going to be a country of pensioners, of old people, that will never rebound. So it's not clear what's going to be happening to it economically because for the past 25 years or even more than that, it's been living off the proceeds of Soviet industrialism. And even though the Soviets built things to last, eventually all of that stuff wears out. Bridges, railroads, power plants, water mains, dams, all of that stuff in the Ukraine hasn't been maintained for that long or has barely been maintained and just falling apart. So what we're looking at is an agrarian, deindustrialized, depopulated region, and that is the best that could happen to it. The worst that could happen to it is that there's the efforts to reestablish control over this territory by whomever fail, and then it becomes a lawless, drug-infested mafia state.
Now, you just mentioned the Ukraine, and growing up, when I would hear about it, that's the way I would hear it. I would hear people call it the Ukraine. And I think a few months ago, I was listening to, just for a moment, I think a liberal commentator on something, and he was quickly talking and he said the Ukraine, and he stopped himself. He said, "Oh, I apologize. I mean Ukraine." And it like flipped, triggered a switch in my head, and I thought, "Wait a second. Is this like woke reframing, Because the Ukraine is kind of like the borderlands. It was an intentional changing of words to redefine what this place is. Am I wrong, or was it something like that?
No. Ukraine is the Polish version of Russian Krai.
Okay.
Krai, if you look at a map or a list of regions of the Russian Federation, all the ones that are over bordering some other country, not all of them, but quite a few of them, are called Krai. And it just means edge. So all of the edge regions are called Krai.
Okay.
And Ukraine is just the sort of Polish version of Krai.
Okay.
And
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
it had a bunch of different names over time, but the new regions that Catherine the Great created, Kharkov, Donetsk, Lugansk, Odessa, Nikolaev, all of those that are now sort of drifting in the direction of Russia, or are already part of Russia, those were called Novo Russia, the new Russia, new Russian territories. Before that, they were empty lands. Further west from there was Malorossiya, the small Russia, which had a very interesting history because it was sometimes part of the Russian Empire and sometimes under the Poles, and sometimes the Austrians made some inroads. Even the Hungarians had something to do with it. And it was rather mixed up and had a complicated history to the point where Kiev was purchased by the Russian Empire from the Poles at one point. They actually paid money to get Kiev back. The term Ukraine, Ukraina, was not really used much until the 20th century, a post-revolutionary effort to create lots of countries instead of one big Russia because it was considered too bad to have and against communist internationalist morals to have one big Russia. It had to be broken up.
DC, let's say, is pulling the strings. Why?
To destroy Russia, that was their brilliant plan. used the Ukraine to destroy Russia. You see, one little secret that shouldn't be a secret about what the Washingtonians is that they don't know anything about Russia at all, and the little that they know is wrong. There are a number of reasons for that. The big one is that when the Soviet Union fell apart, Americans decided that Russia is no longer a problem, so why study it? So they basically took all of the people who were supposed to be Russian scholars and sent them to study Chinese or Arabic or Farsi or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so the Russia hands in the State Department, in the CIA, in the United States, are decidedly third rate and rather thin on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing worse than not knowing what you need to know about a certain region is having bad information.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason why this information is bad is that a lot of it comes from people who you might call them dissidents, but they're no longer called that. They're basically people who don't like Russia,
mm-hmm.
Russians who don't like Russia, emigres,
right,
who went to the United States and decided that they could make money just by bad-mouthing Russia, mm-hmm. telling Americans what they wanted to hear.
Right.
And so what the Americans ended up as a world view, because Russia is a big chunk of the world, is that Russia is fearsome, but weak and could fall apart at any moment and just needs a little push.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Ukraine was the device that they wanted to use to push Russia over the edge.
Right.
The idea is that we provoke Russia into attacking, we accuse Russia of attacking, we accuse Russia of being aggressive, we impose sanctions on Russia, as a result of which the Russian economy collapses, people become unhappy, we finance a color revolution in Moscow, people overthrow Putin, we insert our own proxy Russian president, mm-hmm. and then that Russian president allows us to rush in with our oil companies and gas companies and plunder Russia's natural resources as we would like.
It's funny because I've only been here for 3 years. So I feel myself late to the party of learning about all this. But even I, with my limited knowledge nowadays, if I hear like mainstream media people talking or politicians in the West talking, and they'll say certain things, and I'm like, what are they talking about? It's not just that they have a different opinion. They're either flat out lying or they just legitimately don't know, you know? Like for instance, you know, I've had hope in Trump in the past, but I feel like he legitimately does not know exactly what's going on. And the only pass I could try and give the guy is he's got his own country to deal with, and he's just being whispered things, and he's got Russia like in the distance that he will sometimes attend to. But, you know, I mean, that's as charitable as I can be at this point. I mean, it's crazy. And I think because I was born in 1974 and raised on the Hollywood movies about Russia, it's easy for me to not think deeply and just take it for granted, just be like, oh yeah, okay, it's the bad guys. All right, sure, fine. But I try to go deeper now that I'm getting older and ask why, you know, why? And what I'm getting from what you're telling me is that, you know, it's about the resources, I guess, right? You know, because they say that the goal is to destroy Russia, but then I want to go deeper. Why destroy Russia? Is it because the U.S. needs their resources? Is it like an American football mentality just to win?
Around 2008, the United States was really down for the count because oil ran out. Peak oil came and went in 2005-06, and the U.S. would have collapsed, would have ceased to be an industrialized nation at that point. But then shale oil came on stream and saved the day. And American shale oil is the only thing that has been keeping the United States from collapsing since then. But shale oil has stopped growing for the past 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And the way that the physics of shale oil work, it depletes very, very quickly. A shale well is not like a traditional oil well that, you know, produces oil for a decade or more. It drops by a third or half in the first year of production.
Mm.
So the drilling rate has already dropped in the U.S. The production rate, it will drop next.
Okay.
The United States is absolutely desperate to find a source for oil. It has very few options.
Mm-hmm.
It can drill off the continental shelf in Alaska, but it can't mm-hmm. do that without Russian help because it doesn't have the technology. Only the Russians have that technology.
The special ships, the nuclear icebreakers, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a lot of technology that goes with doing energy projects in the Arctic. Americans just simply don't have it. So one of the things being discussed is cooperation between Russia and the United States in that area, because without it, the United States really can't survive. So that was the hope, that, you know, you use the Ukraine to knock over Russia and take Russia's oil and keep the party going for another few decades, and then maybe something else will happen, or, you know, in the long run, we're all dead, so it doesn't matter. That was the thinking. Didn't work. It did not work.
It's in the 1900s, like late or maybe late 1800s, as New York was growing, they were seeing a real crisis on their hands that they simply would not be able to handle all the manure that the horses were producing. And they didn't know how they were going to get past this. It sounds silly to say now, but then the car was invented and that solved that problem. So yeah, sometimes it's hard for us to see around the horizon. So then what would you say to people sitting in the U.S., you know, good people, hardworking people that are listening to this are a little bit concerned, you know, what Western leaders would you advise them to support? Are there any today that they should support to try and help the U.S. be a functioning country or stay a functioning country?
Become friends with your local drug lords and mafia leaders, because they are the future. The United States is not really a country. It's a collection of states. Half of them don't get along with the other half. The country is held together by the fact that the U.S. Treasury Department still can write checks that don't bounce. But that is a matter of time. If you look at the financial statements of the U.S. government and know just a tiny little bit about how money works, you realize that this thing has pretty much run its course. It's going to fail. It's going to fail dramatically and quickly. And after that, you will have lots of territories, some of which will be snatched up by the Chinese or the Indians or other groups or the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of territories will be given over to drug cartels, which have the most advanced governance structures.
Wow. Like, so you're pretty sure this is going to happen? Because when you first start to say it, a person might want to laugh, and then we realize that you're serious. So you're pretty sure this is the future.
Well, the last thing that happened with the drug cartels is that they have figured out how to defeat the U.S. military. And they did that by going to the Ukraine and seeing how the U.S. military, or the proxy, the Ukrainian proxy for the U.S. military, is being defeated by the Russians. So basically, they went through that learning experience, and now they're better armed with drone aircraft, etc. The border doesn't exist. Their weapons are much more advanced than anything that the U.S. military can offer. And the U.S. military is not even that interested. They would rather just take the money than fight. You know, why sacrifice your life when you can get rich instead?
Do you think that the U.S. was always destined for this, or did it go wrong at some point? Because, you know, the story of being a colony and throwing off British rule and gaining independence, it's an inspiring story. It could they have made gone in the correct direction, or do you think this is something that was always going to come apart?
Well, it's by design. It's the United States of America, and the word united is not necessary. It would be the States of America. And then why talk about them all at once if they don't get along?
Mm.
So you'd have the Western States of America, or the Eastern States of America, or this or that collection. And I lived in Boston, and then I lived in South Carolina, and they're different countries.
So you're saying they forgot to be united? So could they have practiced being united to stop this from happening? Or is that too simple of a way to say it?
I think it would be absolutely pointless. People seriously don't like Yankee land, is what they call it, in South Carolina.
Okay.
And they don't go to Yankee land. It's a foreign country to them. They don't like the Yankees that come over. You know, I've been to California, and the Californians are sort of a subspecies of American that is very different, even though they get along with people, say, from Massachusetts. They're different. They're substantially different cultures.
Okay.
That aren't really compatible. So why tie them together into a single country if Washington fails, if Washington just completely becomes disrupted and non-functional, which is, it's very, very close to that point.
How is Russia different? Because Russia is also in a multi-ethnic place with lots of different territories.
I don't think, well, Comparing the two, I wouldn't even know where to start because it's a different civilization based on different principles. Russia is very centralized in terms of its spirit. And believe it or not, well, the United States is all about commerce. In Russia, it's all about heroic deeds. It's not about making money. It's all about sacrifice.
Okay.
Different mentality, different civilization, different approach to life.
Okay. So you said for a good American, they might want to befriend their local mafia, basically. Might they want to immigrate to Russia?
What I generally tell people is that if they emigrate to Russia, a change in mentality would be required. Being in Russia with an American mentality outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg would probably be a bit painful.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So the first thing to understand is that, you know, a major change in mindset would be required. And then, of course, there's the language, because, you know, that's what really holds Russia together is this bear of a language. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an easy language to learn. It's got complexity and subtlety and different levels that interact in various ways. There's mm-hmm. lots of old Slavonic that sort of bubbles up through the layers. And it's just very complicated, and it takes a long time to learn. Doing so would take years of someone's life, if somebody is talented.
I mean, I'm trying to learn the language. It's tough, though, because I'm doing this show, and I'm, like, working full-time talking to everyone in English. You know, my kids are all bilingual. In fact, the youngest one is I don't even know if you could say he's bilingual, because he just doesn't know English that well, because he's been here, you know, since he was three. They'll teach it to him in school. I think that my kids are almost 100%. Well, I think I could say they are 100% Russian, but they're maybe 30% American as well. And my grandkids, their kids will be completely Russian, I would say. So I think that if you're a religious person who's used to sharing and living in a more communal life with a community, it might be an easier fit for you, I would guess, right?
Well, a lot of the people who come over here, I don't know the percentage-wise, but I've run across many of them, are Russian Orthodox. So the way they get into being Russian is they convert to Russian Orthodoxy, they join some Russian Orthodox parish, they meet a bunch of Russians, they come over here, they also visit parishes and meet people and make friends here. And that really makes it for a smooth transition.
Right.
Because people are receptive and they speak the same language religiously, even if they don't speak Russian, they can still communicate on that level. There's a ritual to tie it all together. That's the beautiful way to go, I would say. If you want to move to Russia, just, I'm Russian Orthodox, so I'm prejudiced in favor of that, but that's the way to go.
Is there anything that you miss about the West?
Sailing around the Eastern Seaboard was really fun. I went from Maine to Florida and back.
Wow.
Just by sail a couple of times. And there are lots of little harbors that I miss.
Yeah, that sounds very nice. Do you get to sail here at all?
Not really. The sailing season is short. The Gulf of Finland, I'm in St. Petersburg. The Gulf of Finland is shale, most of it. So there aren't that many places where you can sail a keelboat. There's Ladoga Lake, but Ladoga Lake is vicious. It's fresh water. So when the waves kick up, they're very steep. And they do so without warning because it's pretty far north. And the weather is just violent,
right.
So that's really tough. There aren't that many places to go sailing. If I was on the Black Sea coast, then yes, I would probably get a little yacht.
Right. Well, you can vacation there and rent something, I suppose, when you have time, right?
That's true.
That's cool. I didn't know you were in St. Petersburg. I was just there and did a couple of videos. So, would you recommend St. Petersburg for Westerners that want to immigrate to Russia?
I don't know. See, St. Petersburg, it's got a very compact, very busy center that is touristy.
Yes.
And interesting and a nice place to live. I live right in the center. So everything I need is within two city blocks of where I am.
Oh,
I don't need to drive at all. But around that is not even suburbs, but rings of high-rises.
Mm.
And that's the part of the city that I don't like that much, even though I grew up there. And beyond that is suburbia. It's really like three different environments to choose from. It's 5 million people, but there are a lot of really nice smaller cities, and I would encourage people to look at them. Almost every city in Russia now is livable. Even the smallest places still have schools and clinics and hospitals and just everything you need to live.
It's unbelievable how Russia is improving the infrastructure just all over the place, because I've done lots of videos in these smaller places, and it's just they're really fixing them up. They're really making them fresh and nice and livable.
That's right. So I would encourage people to buy into that instead of going to where it's already super built up and incredibly busy and expensive.
Dmitry, thank you so much for coming on. Guys, please go to his blog. I have put it in the description. Also, like and subscribe here. Share this video with other people so they can learn more of the truth about what's going on in this country. They can learn more about this guy. And thank you so much for watching.
Thank you. This was great.